23, I'll be corrected to drive, but you have a fire in a one story.
Well, Happy New Year, everybody. This is John Murphy. I'm going to be your dashboard operator. I'm a attorney at law. This is our fire service court session for the first one for 2022, and I'm happy to be here tonight. It looks like I'm flying solo. Not sure where Kurt Verone or Brad Pinsky are. They're probably out practicing the dark art of law in their respective areas. I do know that Chip Comstock indicated that he was going to not be available tonight, or a low possibility that he's available because he had something going on today that he was unable to make it tonight. So we'll just go without those guys. They will be available at FDIC in April 2022 in Indianapolis. I will be available at the newly, incorporated or associative conference called GEMSCON. It's going to be at the same time that FDIC is going to be in Indianapolis, a week-long EMS-specific presentation. I'm doing a session on the law, as are our two other or three other attorneys will be at FDIC, but we're all going to be together in a gigantic pile in Indianapolis in 2022, April. Looking forward to seeing all of you there. It was funny to me, but I know that I'm getting older, and I think that we in our business, especially EMS side, is getting a little, our history is being not ignored, but, as the new generation comes up, they didn't grow up on the television show Emergency, set in L.A., California. Over 50 years ago, I think the show had its anniversary. Anyway, as older firefighters, we probably grew up watching the show on television. And the other one that I'm sorry to hear that's not got the wide audience is Monty Python. And so I had the opportunity to teach a chapter three of the EMT manual to new recruit firefighters in an academy. And so part of the class was channeling situational awareness, and if you get into a room with a patient, always have an exit. And so we talked about protecting yourself and watching yourself on the highways and electrical hazards, and there's increased violence against EMS providers and firefighters. And so I was talking about what's sort of a default position to getting out of the room. There's a Monty Python rule that most of us older firefighters would know, which is running away. And I was pretty quiet in the class, and I said, who can cite the Monty Python rule? And one kid popped up. He said, get naked. I'm thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. I had never heard the get naked clause in the Monty Python rule, but if that works, I guess it's okay. Certainly would distract the agitated patient. And you can always run away. So running away while naked is not really the Monty Python rule, but certainly we're willing to accept change in any scenario. 2022 brings on, again, a lot of issues dealing with the COVID-mandated vaccine. As if any of you have been following the Supreme Court lately, the latest ruling was basically to stay, which means to put on hold, the mandate that Biden administration put into place. There was a case called the National Federation of Independent Business versus the Department of Labor, case filed in November. And it basically required all employers with 100 more employees, which consists of two-thirds of the private sector, to compel those employees to either be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or be tested weekly and wear masks. And so the government expected the mandate to cover approximately 84 million employees. it set the fire service on its ear because part of that mandate dealt with healthcare providers and certainly employers of over 100. And I know that I and my fellow attorneys received phone calls from fire chiefs and other EMS administrators about how does this affect our workforce. And the expectation, that we're going to have a mass exodus of individuals who do not want to receive the mandate, but who will be willing to wear a mask or get tested and or applied for an exemption under a religious or medical exemption. And what, you know, what ended up happening is not as many people left as we thought were going to leave. There were still some granting of the exception in the arena of religious or medical exemptions, but, you know, like a lot of employers not have the capacity to manage someone who has an exemption because, you know, you cannot have perpetual light duty. And so it was thought, I think for a brief second, that the latest Supreme Court decision and this independent decision would relieve some of the pressure on the fire department. And, you know, just kind of, if you're interested in reading it, you can look on SCOTUS blog, S-C-O-T-U-S blog, and it sort of discusses the case, and there's a pretty good rendition of that written by an author named Amy Howe in the opinion analysis on SCOTUS.blog.com, or SCOTUSblog.com, I'm sorry. And so what, you know, she indicated was that the, you know, Congress didn't give the Department of Labor the power to establish safety standards. I'm sorry, let me repeat myself. It did give the Department of Labor the power to establish safety standards, but not broad public health measures. So, you know, that's sort of where the rub came in. And so there's a couple of cases in the lower court that are still pending on the decision on employer mandates and employee mandates. And so as those get resolved at the lower courts, then I think the Supreme Court will come back and make a decision based on that. The article kind of goes through the dissent and the supporters, and it talks about the vaccine or test mandate will remain on hold while the challenges to its legality continues in the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Sixth Court. However, as ordinary, as usual, we can see there's been an exception made in another case for healthcare providers. And so in the case, which was ruled pretty much at the same time as the prior case in Biden versus Missouri, the justices agreed to allow the Biden administration to enforce nationwide rule that rules under all healthcare workers at facilities that participates in Medicare and Medicaid programs to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 unless they qualify for the medical or religious exemption. This affects about 10 million workers. And the question is, does it affect the fire service? Because in some form or fashion, as EMTs, first responders, or paramedics, we are healthcare providers. And I know that many of us will argue against that, but we've argued against our ability to protect the public, our ability to protect ourselves. And certainly, I'm a vaccine person. I've had the vaccine. I've been boosted. I do wear a mask. I do practice health. I'm a healthcare provider as a physician's assistant for an occupational health company here in the Pacific Northwest. And so I believe in the vaccines, but obviously there's a lot of people that do not, and I have to treat them. And so I do my best to protect myself as a healthcare provider. So the question is, so Health and Human Services, again, is responsible to ensure that healthcare providers who care for Medicare or Medicaid patients protect their patients' health and safety, hence the vaccine mandate. So how does that affect you and your organization? So if you're a healthcare provider in the public sector as a firefighter, EMT, or a paramedic, and you bill for services, does that put you under the obligation of the Health and Human Services rule that you have to get vaccinated? Or are you part of the sort of the general public or general populace that you know, you're on hold. And I think what we're going to see in the long run, that the Health and Human Services and CMS vaccine mandate will apply to us in some form or fashion. In a article that was written by the IAFC, Ken LaSala, he's the Director of Government Relations and Policy, writes a little snapshot of, talked about the Supreme Court ruling, and again, blocked the emergency temporary standard by OSHA, required again the 100 employer or greater mark. But it did uphold the staff vaccination mandate by Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's the CMS that we alluded to earlier. And the mandate specifically affects the following Medicare and Medicaid certified providers. And it goes through a whole list of hospitals and nursing homes and other entities that provide healthcare services for the public. But the question is, again, how does this affect fire and EMS? Again, are generally not covered by the CMS rule specifically. It doesn't say that we're in there, but it doesn't specifically exclude us. However, if a fire or EMS department is engaged in interfacility transport or transport to a facility and bill for those particular services, then they need to have some discussion with your Center for Medicare Services representative to see how they are affected. Again, I think the default position from an attorney and a healthcare provider, and hopefully my fellow attorneys would agree, that you continue the mandate for your employers, I'm sorry, the employees, the firefighters, EMTs, first responders, for both volunteer and career, continue to vaccinate your employees. And again, it's to protect them, it's to protect the public, protect families, protecting the community. So I think we need to think about that. If you're still interested in reading additional material, there's a publication called the National Law Review at www.nationallawreview.com that basically does a small article about the CMS rules and who is affected. Again, it does not specifically include or exclude public safety, but I think that we're going to be seeing some information coming out of either OSHA or and a clarification of the rule, or even your state safety organizations. It may be OSHA compliant, if your state is OSHA compliant, or you have some sort of an OSHA exclusion that basically you follow the OSHA standard. And again, the mandate for vaccine has been placed on hold until the decision is made at the Sixth Circuit Court. So here we are. We're back to not ground zero. I think we've done a lot of good by getting vaccines for our firefighters. And again, whether you believe that in them or not, don't kill the messenger. Get the facts, read the science, make a decision for yourself, and I think you and your family will be better off as a result of it. But one of the other things that I wanted to talk about, and I wrote an article last year sometime, talking about qualified immunity for the fire service, because one of the things that I am seeing, and there's a lot of articles written in our journals anyway, on the law side, is that qualified immunity is being seriously discussed, I think, at the legislative level, certainly in the state, my state of Washington, probably your states, and certainly at the federal level. And so I wanted to just kind of go over briefly how qualified immunity affects you as a provider, protects you in actions, omissions, or commissions that may occur in your practice in the field as paramedics, EMTs, or firefighters. And certainly, we're seeing a lot of heat on the police officers in a qualified immunity challenge. When you look at the recent George Floyd events, the recent shootings of African-American men, by the police. And certainly we're not too much involved in that, but, you know, we're public safety officers, and we are necessarily incorporated and involved in those sorts of things, but not as directly as the police are. So I think what we need to do is just sort of have this intelligent discussion about what qualified immunity really is. So needless to say, you know, the company discussion and some impactful litigation compelling the discussion. And as we watched the national news last year, and again, it's, you know, the same repetitive events that are going on this year, we're seeing challenges to the qualified immunity statutes or laws that help protect us in our, what we do day to day. Qualified immunity protects, you know, state and local officials, firefighters, teachers, school administration, anyone in the public service from civil liability or following the rules and regulations set forth by the laws that they are sworn to uphold. Firefighters and law enforcement officials who objectively were acting in good faith under the color of law are protected by a qualified immunity. And when you talk about, you know, how can you breach the qualified immunity, like many states, including my state and your state, has qualified immunity statutes in there. And so what protects you from, you know, litigation, essentially, on the civil side? And so, you know, you have ordinary negligence. You forget to do something and the outcome is bad. You get sued by your patient or their family. And, you know, the defense is, under the qualified immunity statute, is you did everything possible in order to prevent death or injury or, you know, that sort of stuff. Sometimes if we are negligent, either intentionally or vicariously or those sorts of things, and I think there's a little bit more ability to successfully sue us as providers than if we acted in good faith and followed the law. Despite statements and other opinions, qualified immunity is not granted to every public service responder, including law enforcement and firefighters in every case. Qualified immunity also does not protect public servants from criminal charges, internal investigations, discipline, and potential termination. As we've seen lately, the lower courts and the U.S. Supreme Court continues to uphold qualified immunity, and the doctrine in its entirety has held firm and withstood recent and political legal debates and challenges. A little bit of history on this, which was an education to me as well. The creation of qualified immunity occurred in the Civil Rights Act of 1871. And then, interestingly enough, it was also known as the Ku Klux Klan Act. Congress gave Americans the right to sue public officials who violate their legal rights in Section 1983 of the U.S. Code, which is the modern analog of the 1871 Civil Rights Act. Congress said that if a public official violates your rights, whether via police brutality, an illegal search, or an unlawful arrest, you can file a lawsuit to hold that the public official was financially accountable of the conduct. And we see this again in the Fourth Amendment, where it protects your, you know, rights against unlawful incursion, possession of your personal possessions, you know, other sorts of protections that we find in the amendments, right? The language Congress issued was unequivocal. It said every state official who causes a deprivation of any rights guaranteed by the Constitution and the law shall be liable to the injured party. 15 years after that decision, and the Supreme Court held in Harlow v. Fitzgerald, a 1982 case, federal government officials are entitled to qualified immunity. Immunity in this doctrine is to provide immunity from suit rather than a mere defense to liability. Essentially, the government officials became incapable of being sued instead of merely having an additional defense theory to raise in civil action pursued against them. Also, in Michael v. Forsyth, a 1985 case, qualified immunity is a commonly and successfully used as a significant defense to Section 1983 civil rights actions. Interestingly enough, qualified immunity is not a law. It is a judicial doctrine set by the Supreme Court that other courts must follow. That's why Congress can consider ending it are changing it as a legal shield that allows an officer to not be civilly, financially liable if they violate somebody's civil rights. It also applies to other public officials during their employees' on-duty work for the government, as long as the alleged misdeeds are not contrary to clearly established law. In cases applied to the fire department related treatment and patient care issues, the California Supreme Court upheld qualified immunity as it applies to paramedics, citing the existing law, and providing qualified immunity to a police fire department response to an injured patient with a paramedic patient care support. Cases named are Zepeda versus the City of Los Angeles. It's a 1990 case. The case unequivocally is related to paramedic liability, and qualified immunity also mentioned in an unpublished opinion of the similar case entitled Eastburn versus Regional Fire Protection Authority, where the higher circuit courts decided whether public entities employing emergency dispatchers are subject to direct or vicarious tort liability for injury attributable in part to a dispatcher's failure to or delay in responding to a 911 call for an electrocution of a child. That case is the San Bernardino County Superior Court. I'm not really sure when that was. But anyway, there's liability, immunity for liability in these cases. So, but again, you need to be acting in good faith. In another case related to firefighters treating and restraining a combative patient, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has joined a growing number of circuit courts holding that fire EMS personnel who restrain a combative patient should not be evaluated under the Fourth Amendment excessive force analysis that applies to police officers. Rather, fire and EMS personnel acting as medical responders, not as law enforcement officers, and as such may be acting in an objectively reasonable manner when administering a sedative to a patient for purposes of qualified immunity. That ruling was handed down in a lawsuit brought by Brittany Buckley on a 2017 incident where paramedics came from Hennepin County and administered ketamine to sedate her for transport to a hospital. She contends that the use of the sedative was unnecessary and such as constituted the use of excessive force. She also claimed the medics, the hospital, and the physicians violated her due process rights because the ketamine was administered as part of a study. Steve Buckley v. Hennepin County, and that's a 2021 case. Probably the most recent high-profile issue of restraint that used force by both police and fire departments involving the patient Elijah McClain. Recently, there's a settlement reached between the parents of the deceased Elijah McClain and the city of Aurora, which totaled $15 million, making it one of the largest police-related settlements in Colorado history. Remember the reported facts that Elijah McClain was not suspected of committing any crime during the time of his arrest in August 2019. Rather, he'd been walking home from a convenience store when somebody called 911 to report suspicious activity. Reports detail officers' physical assault of McClain and the paramedics' administration of the powerful anesthetic ketamine at a dose too high for someone of his size. The settlement comes after a grand jury issued 32 indictments against three Aurora police officers and the two paramedics involved in detaining McClain. That case is still going on. And so the issue of qualified immunity, my question to you, my audience is, does this apply and can they claim the qualified immunity statute protecting them from harm? Excuse me. Again, his death, Elijah McClain, helped inspire a new police accountability law in Colorado that limits first responders' ability to use ketamine. And many of our high-profile national law firms dealing with EMS law have written a couple of articles about it and the use of ketamine as an anesthetic in the field. And again, the jury's out, literally, I think, on these other issues, because I think there's the grand jury. There'll be probably criminal charges against these five individuals, and that certainly doesn't invoke the qualified immunity statute for the paramedics. But that case is sort of ongoing. So monthly, or if you're interested in it, just, you know, check it out. It's an Aurora, Colorado case. I think it's interesting as it deals with, you know, how do we restrain patients? And one of the issues in my class yesterday at the EMT level is, you know, use of physical restraint. So, you know, is compression restraint illegal? And especially if you have somebody who says, I cannot breathe, what's our obligation? The other is you go to an EMS call for a patient in control or in custody of the police officers, and the police officers have them hogtied, which is not an approved restraining mechanism anymore, because many people have died as a result of that from, you know, a couple of conditions. One is excited delirium, where the patient is maybe overdosed on some cocaine is an example, or something that would raise their heart rate. And also in raising their heart rate in an excited delirium situation, they become hyperthermic. And so hyperthermia at a high enough tension will cause cardiac arrest. Sometimes the patients are laid on or kneed on by the providers, and it restricts their ability to breathe. And, you know, they may die from, you know, compression asphyxia, which is directly caused by us. So, my advice to my students is, you know, you have to intervene. You just cannot go along and get along with something that you see as clearly a violation of their rights, and certainly a medical emergency that, you know, you need to, you know, unrestrain or tell the cops to take off parts of the restraint so this person can breathe and get them out of there into the hospital. Another case, which is in Texas, a 2020 case, federal judge in Dallas decided that two firefighters whose lack of action led to a man dying due to a brain bleed can be sued by the victim's family. The man died after he was taken to Dallas jail, despite begging for help and telling the police that he was injured. His body was found hours later under his jail mattress. A couple of paramedics, again, we'll go through these cases. There's enough case law out here, I think, that you get the gist that, you know, not everything we do is protected under qualified immunity. And it basically will provide protection for us, but not in, you know, negligence or, you know, gross negligence or, you know, those sorts of things that we intentionally either ignore the patient or we go out of our way to harm a patient. And it really doesn't involve, you know, self-defense. Sometimes, you know, we do get attacked by patients. I tell my class, and you should have learned this, is that you can run away. I would imagine that you'd run away naked, like my student said the other day on the Monty Python question, but certainly get out of the room, get out of the way, take care of yourself, and, you know, live to fight another day. But the restraint or the, you know, what you can perform in self-defense is to subdue or stop the hostile action on the side of the patient. But it doesn't mean that you can pound the tar out of that person after he's basically subdued and constrained. So you got to stop at some point. And I know that maybe an anger management issue, or you're just so inflamed by being attacked on somebody. But again, if you exceed, you know, a use of force on a patient, then your qualified immunity may disappear. That's not going to be my judgment. That'll be a prosecuting attorney's opinion. But anyway, just be a word to the wise. Let's see, another Connecticut case, an opinion from the Attorney General's Office related to volunteer firefighters, holds that state law makes anyone who's in a unpaid volunteer for a municipal agency immune from negligence liability for damages or injuries resulting in any act, error, or omission made in the exercise of his policy or decision-making decisions if, one, he or she was acting in good faith and within the scope of their official functions and duties, and two, was not acting in violation of any state, municipal, or professional code of ethics regulating their conduct. The estate opinion and the federal immunity and every immunity statute that you have, and you all have them, do not apply to reckless, willful, or wanton misconduct, civil rights violations, or intentional torts such as an assault and battery, false imprisonment, invasion of privacy, or defamation. So those are fairly broad standards. You learned it all in your EMT class and probably as a paramedic. Any firefighter should know this, and certainly every police officer in the country understands, you know, how that those words will affect them. And the separate Connecticut statute, which was nice, I don't know if they threw this in because, but bars trespass actions against firefighters. Go on to property extinguisher or investigate fires. So you need to check your state law. And I'm sure all of our state laws have that same provision in there that we are able to go on people's property without the danger of trespass to suppress, you know, a fire or other sorts of things. And again, closer to my home and certainly in your houses, the law that is rooted, that was intended to protect Americans from harm caused by state officials. Our former state attorney general, Rob McKenna, said that these rules date back to the adoption of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War. Several years ago, again in my state, the former attorney general, Slade Gordon, opinion related to the application of our RCW 1871.210, and he indicated that was designed to insulate certain persons from liability for rendering emergency medical services. Specifically, that section concerns itself with the medical services rendered by mobile technicians and paramedics. Other cases, again, taking a look at, you know, I think the term could be like ordinary negligence. So the case was, this was an unpublished opinion up here in our state. The case is Leah Samuels v. Multicare Health Systems. A nurse practitioner in the city of Tacoma, and the appeals court ruled that while applying the RCW I just recited earlier, granting qualified immunity to first responders and healthcare providers, the RCW to the case of the patient care who believed she was having a stroke, and that upon the initial paramedic evaluation, they did not find signs or symptoms of a stroke, documented it. Thank God for that. So make sure you do your documentation well. At the time of their visit and left her home, she sought other opinions over the next several days, and finally a physician discovered that she in fact did suffer a stroke, and the patient sued all of her providers, including the city of Tacoma. And so, you know, after a lot of court action and some hubbub that goes on, the court ordered or determined that the city of Tacoma was entitled to qualified immunity, dismissing her negligence claim and awarding statutory costs to the city. And she appealed it to our state Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court indicated that the RCW 1871, the immunity statute, applies as there are no genuine issues of material fact under the gross negligence standard. And the city and the providers, and again, as a provider, your employer there's a vicarious liability standard, which your employer is responsible for all of your actions unless it's criminal, discriminatory, you know, those sort of disclaimers in there. But generally, your employer is the person or is the entity that's responsible for your actions. And so, again, we talked about the qualified immunity. And there's a big push to end qualified immunity, I think, at the national level and certainly at the state level, where there are a lot of motions last year, at the end of last year, and I haven't heard much this year, but it doesn't mean it's not continuing, is to defund or decrease the, you know, the size of police departments and also eliminate their qualified immunity statutes to make them liable for actions that are deemed to be grossly negligent. And so state legislators across the country tried to undo the legal doctrine that makes it virtually impossible to sue. Again, the George Floyd case was the big initiator of this particular movement. But on the good side, as of the last research, they said at least 35 state qualified immunity bills have died in the last year. We take a look at the various cities around the country. You know, there's a new batch of legislators in there. Some are pretty liberal, some are pretty socialist, some are pretty, you know, mainstream, some are the right, some are on the left, some are old, have been there for a long period of time. So I think, you know, what we're seeing is a sort of pendulum swing either to the right or left, depending what your viewpoint is. on how qualified immunity affects you. Certainly, as a provider in the fire service, as healthcare providers, as paramedics, EMTs, we want that type of qualified immunity. Not every single patient outcome is positive. You know, people die, people don't get better. Sometimes, you know, we may injure them inadvertently. And again, that's where the qualified immunity comes in to help protect us as healthcare providers, as firefighters, as volunteers. And so for our line of business, there's sort of sweep for ending qualified immunity affecting the police department. You know, in parentheses, it could affect all public safety officers and officials, which is us as providers, and then and your city officials and your department. And sort of kind of getting to the end of this is only a sample of the end of the qualified movement for public safety, mostly, as I said, based on the actions of the police, but the overall effect will affect you and I and our ability to protect ourselves against unintended harm or omissions in the course of our duty. And again, it's important for us, I think, to understand what our liabilities are. It's important for us to understand, you know, what our protocols are. Do we exceed protocols? Do we use medications if you're a paramedic inappropriately? How do we deal with the public and, you know, our people that we're responsible for will be a 911 call. Many, again, of the issues noted above with the case law and many more cases that were not mentioned in this particular presentation can be avoided by treating every patient for citizen interaction as they were members of your family, right? Remember your protocols, training, don't intentionally harm a patient. Do not take shortcuts in patient care. Do not falsify your documents. And one of the cases, the Texas case, the judge or the grand jury found that the paramedics altered their records to meet the police. A lot of the stuff was sort of police, you know, you should do this, we should do this. And the records were actually falsified. And I think it dealt with the one that the gentleman was in jail and died in the jail. But don't falsify records. Your records are your cornerstone of an affirmative defense. So it's everything that you did right. You know, nobody else has those particular documents. You didn't, you know, nobody else wrote those documents. You wrote and authored those documents. Those are your memories, right? So when you go to court, or if you go to court, you know, that's your recall memory, and it's very, very important that you do your documentation honestly and accurately. We want to be honest and truthful. And again, we're not machines, but humans, that we do make mistakes, and then make sure that you're acting in good faith and within the scope of your official function and duties. And do not act in violation of any state, municipal, or professional code of ethics regulating your conduct. Remember, qualified immunity is a defense available to all first responders, but let's not find ourselves in a situation where qualified immunity will be waived because of your actions. That pretty much ends the show. It almost set the record for the show that we had in December between Chip and I on. It was the night before Christmas and all through the house, which I thought was kind of funny, but I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, I wish you all a good night. Be very, very careful out there. Protect yourself. And we'll see you all at FDIC and certainly at our next radio show in a couple of months. Take care. Good night.